Welcome back to another episode of Phil Green is Clocked Off. You came back, you had an episode, and it didn't put you off enough to where you're listening to another episode, and that's great, and I appreciate you for it. This one's really fun. This is an episode with Andrew Games, who is a professional actor, and we talk about the one time that he tried to make some big money. So if you want to hear about big money, professional acting, and the time that 5 million people watched me do myself some serious damage, this is the episode for you. And as always, I'm doing this all on a shoestring. It's all being done free of charge. So for the next 30 seconds, listen to how I get to make that possible. All right, hello, and welcome to another episode of Phil Green is Clocked Off. And today we are talking to Andrew Games. Andrew, how are you doing?
Good evening, or at least it's evening for me over here, probably broad daylight for you over there. I'm all right. I'm really good. How about yourself?
I'm doing well. The sun is miraculously cracking the flags. It's about 5 o'clock in the afternoon while we're recording this. I have a beer in hand because we're all working from home right now, so there is no commute, so happy days.
Happy days.
So, Andrew, you and I met probably, 4 years ago?
It was 2017.
So 3 years ago.
3 years ago, yeah.
And how did we meet?
So we're both wrestling fans, or Mark. If you're in the biz or familiar with the biz.
Some insider terminology.
Of course, yeah. just trying not to break the kayfabe, yeah. That's probably gone over a lot of people's heads. But we both were active in the independent wrestling scene. So I'm an actor by trade and profession, but I also do camera work. So I was the artistic director for the camera crew at an independent wrestling promotion called TNT, whilst you, Phil, I believe, were the warm-up act.
Yes, so I had two particular roles with that company. I did some warm-up for them, which went so well that a video of me doing that has over 5 million views on YouTube, and not because my act was so good, but because I jumped on something that I thought was a set of stairs but was actually a cardboard box, went right through it, and the video of my demise was very successful on social media.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, it was on Botchamania.
It sure was. It sure was.
I don't think TNT's been on Botchamania ever since either.
Yeah, that's the value that I bring to your promotion, folks. I will die for your company, apparently. So I was a professional faller over for the company, but I also did what we call, again, in the biz, to pull back the curtain, I did a color commentary, which is in character commentary, where you kind of, you'll have a guy that will explain what's actually happening in the ring, and then you'll have a character explaining why it's important. So I did that, and how I did that is a fun story. I went to that company's first ever show, and this was, so for their first ever show, we'll just interview me for the next 20 minutes. How about that?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Feel free to ask me any questions as I go. So I went to their very first ever show, and what they did for their first show was they hired another company to come and run a show, but under the TNT name.
It was a company
called Extreme Wrestling something or other, I don't even know. It's a Midlands-based firm. And they came up to Liverpool and ran a show, but it was under the TNT banner. And I went to the show, I watched the show, and to drop a name, I was stood there with Johnny Bongo of Bongo's Bingo fame.
Wow.
And hey, there is no name I will not drop. And it wasn't very good. So I went home, I got on Facebook, and I messaged the TNT account and basically said, your ring announcer was bad, let me do it. And they said, we already have a different ring announcer, but do you want to come and do commentary? And I said, sure. And the rest was history. And that's how we met.
Wow. Was it just as simple as that? Just dropping them a message and being blunt, saying, by the way, your ring announcer's awful. Give me the job instead. And they were like, well, you can do commentary. Just go, yeah. Okay.
I'd been involved in wrestling for a number of years before I did that. You know, I'd wrestled. I'd done pretty much everything there is to do in wrestling except for actually be good at it. So I shot them a message and kind of outlined my experience, including what one fan on a forum referred to as reminding them that they were at an indie show during a Preston City Wrestling show that had the likes of Tommy Dreamer and Johnny Gargano and Kevin Owens and Goldust. I ruined that show for somebody. I made them regret buying that ticket. So I kind of messaged them a brief outline of my experiences, and then lo and behold, I started working for TNT. So we were here to talk about me and everything I do. But while we're talking about me, I guess we can talk about you for a little bit. So you are an actor. That's correct, yeah. A proper real life working actor. What does that involve? What does it mean to be able to put actor as your actual job?
It's a very interesting question, and there are various different avenues. There are a lot of actors who go to drama school and they kind of grow from there, whereas in my case as an actor, I've got every qualification you can think of apart from a university degree. And the reason why is because there was a lot of actors who I spoke to during my educational years who went to university, and a lot of them said, you know, when you graduate from uni, a lot of people never act again because they either grow to hate it because it becomes a chore, or you graduate and you still want to do it, but because you've had no professional experience, it's harder to find work because the qualification says one thing, but experience, professional experience is another. So I took a gamble. As soon as I finished college, I literally just threw myself out there. I networked as much as I could. I got as much experience as I could. So within the 3 years I could have spent at university getting a degree, I was able to get a professional status, if you'd like. I was part of the, there's two different kind of actors dictionaries in England. There's Equity and there's Spotlight. They're both more or less the same. So I was able to get on Spotlight within the first year of acting on my own freelance. So that is almost like what kind of gives you the credibility of being a proper actor, if you'd like. So I've been acting, I've been an active performer for 12 years, but I've been doing it professionally for 6. It's a very unpredictable lifestyle. You don't know when the next job's going to be. You could have a role. What I mean by a role, I mean you could have a role of work, you know, just ongoing work for about 6 months, and it feels amazing, you know. And then it's just quiet for another 6 months, and you've only got so much money. So a lot of actors, and I've been no exception to this, a lot of actors have had to work in the service industry in between acting gigs. So with actors, usually they try and balance two different lifestyles. They balance, you know, the kind of cookie cutter cashier, hello, nice day, nice to meet you, blah blah blah, and then, you know, and then they've got to have this this creative persona, which a lot of people don't get to see unless they're in the industry themselves and you're rehearsing or you're learning lines at home. Sometimes, which is something that I've done in recent years, is create my own opportunity. So I'm currently making a film, which I've been making for 4 years, but we've been filming for 2. So a lot of actors, there's different avenues, different routes. I said route instead of route, you know, just to kind of make it a bit
I appreciate that translation.
No, I assume that your core audience will mostly be American, so I'm keeping that in mind.
If any Americans are listening to this, Andrew is from Liverpool, so subtitles will be available.
Oh yeah. Scouse is, I'll tell you something about Scouse. Scouse is 80% slang, 20% English, so it almost is its own language in a way.
I would define Scouse as an entire city agreeing to say things wrong. And we've all just kind of accepted it, and we're just going to go on with it anyway. And as long as we all say the same wrong thing, we'll be okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're a professional actor. You're making your own movie. And as you kind of touched upon, probably the biggest piece of acting that any professional actor needs to do as they're starting out is acting the role of the customer service employee. So getting clocked off is all about venting and talking about the worst job you've ever had. So well, before we get into that, break down for me kind of what the line is for making that decision that, okay, I've been acting consistently for the past few months, and now things have kind of dried up a little bit for me, so I'm gonna go ahead and just get a job for a little bit. Like, when does that decision get made? Is it when the bailiffs start knocking? Is it when the electricity gets turned off? Is it a couple of months before we hit that point? What's the thought process?
I think a lot of it comes down to the diary. If you look in the diary, it depends on how regular the work is. Sometimes you can lose track of what dates you've been booked for. And if I've got nothing 6 months from now, I'll think, right, be sensible, get a job, even just part-time, so you've got a regular income whilst you're still putting yourself out there. Because as you've probably seen on social media, you know, I market myself a lot. And, you know, I'm very savvy when it comes to that. And being self-represented, I've been represented by agents in the past as well, but for the most part, I've been self-represented. In some cases, that makes things harder for yourself, because people are always going to go to the agent rather than the sole lone ranger, the Mad Max of the industry, you know.
With the way things are going right now, that Mad Max quote might not be too far off the mark pretty soon.
Oh yeah. Except I won't be wearing leather. I'll probably be in my pajamas and Crocs.
Your personal lifestyle choices are your personal lifestyle choices.
But I would say the line is, if there's nothing in the diary for 6 months, then it is probably best to find a job, even if it's just part-time. So that's the line, I'd say.
Okay. So we're thinking kind of pretty proactive with this. So we'll set the scene. So it's a couple of years ago. You don't have anything in the diary for 6 months, and you decide it's time to pull yourself up by the bootstraps, and you go out and find work, and that leads us to the worst job you have ever had.
Oh boy, here we go. So a little few other things to add the pressure as well to find a job at this time. The urgency was, I also got into a long distance relationship at the time as well with someone who lived in Germany, and you know, we really wanted to make a mutual effort to see each other as often as we could, and just relying on acting work alone at that point just wasn't going to be possible. So that was another reason why I thought, right, I'm going to have to get a job now, because my next acting job isn't until, you know, halfway through the year. And at the time, I lived with my parents as well, and they're very, they're not conservative in a political sense, but they're very conservative in the sense that you've got to have a job and blah, blah, blah. And when, as long as you're under their household, they'll never force you to do anything, but they won't get off your tail about it either. So they're like, oh, you've got to get a job, got to get a job. And I agreed with them. I was like, yeah, I agree. You know, had this girlfriend who lived far away, who I really wanted to see.
Being there.
Yeah. And well, you follow through. You're living there now. So kudos to you. So it was January 2018. I thought, if any of this is going to work, I'm going to have to get a job. That I was struggling for a long time before then. Anyway, I was looking for a short while to find one, and I really struggled. I was scrolled down, was on a website called Indeed. I assume it's popular in the States as well. So I was scrolling down the page, and there was an advert for a waiter needed for a Chinese restaurant in Birkenhead. Because you're more familiar with America than I am. What would you compare Birkenhead to in American wise? Just so they got an understanding of the kind of area that we're talking about here.
I don't know if necessarily Birkenhead has an equal. Maybe Coney Island in New York.
Ah, that's a shout.
You know what I'm saying? As in the Warriors, where it's the kind of place that doesn't feel like it should be a real place, but it is. And it's trying so desperately to be New York, but it isn't.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail right on the head. Coney Island, I didn't think of that. But it's like the Wild West. It's like the Wild West of Merseyside, Birkenhead. But I was just really desperate. So there was a phone number. There wasn't a button to apply. On the website, there was a phone number, and it said Texas number. So a Texas number, and a pitch. Myself as I could, trying to sell myself. I cut a decent promo again with the wrestling terminology.
We're pulling back.
We're coming for you.
This is the dark side of the ring on Vice now. We've changed podcasts. That's
it is. Which I just watched the New Jack episode just before this.
I'll tell you about it afterwards. Yeah, please do.
So a Texas number, sold myself. And I got this text back, and it was in broken English, and it was like, start tomorrow, big money.
Was that like an offer of big money, or did that become your nickname?
I'm the poster boy of this Chinese restaurant. I asked. I said, "What's the wage?" Because it wasn't explicit on the site, and it'll be clear why as the story
goes on. Red flag number one, yeah.
And he was like, "Trial week, £40 a shift. After that, big money." And I was like, "Okay." I said, "Where do we go?" He gave me the address, and I went. And on the outside, I mean, considering the area it was in, on the outside, it looked quite presentable and it looked quite glitz and glam. And then you step inside and it's quite quaint and nice. But they can't. I went in and there was a waitress there, Chinese waitress. I said, "Hello, I'm Andrew. I'm here for my trial shift." And she kind of looked at me as if to say, we weren't expecting you. And then the manager from over the bar kind of gave me an apron, and he was like it was very broken English. A lot of it was kind of exaggerated expression through face and body language, kind of directed me what to do. He was like, go around, glasses, the only thing he didn't say was big money at the end, which would have been
So this is the very first thing that happens. You get up, you have an apron thrust upon you, and there's no paperwork, there's no onboarding, you're just in and collecting glasses.
My words, you just brought back some memory. There was no paperwork at all. It was literally a rogue restaurant. And I remember the music. So they had ambient music on, and it was on loop. It was like the same 10 track, but it was Chinese covers of, which didn't make sense to me, but it was Chinese covers of ballads in a restaurant. And first of all, having ballads in a restaurant is one thing, but they were like, it was like Time After Time by Cyndi Lauper, but in Chinese. And I don't mean Chinese speaking English. It was like in Cantonese Chinese. And it was just a weird juxtaposition. You had this restaurant where people were coming with the families to eat, and then you had like a really sad ballad in the background, and it was a song that you were familiar with, but you were hearing it in a different language. It was just like the aesthetic and everything, it was just really odd. But I remember, and I was really excited to hear it every time, they had Bohemian Rhapsody in Chinese.
Did they have like the harmonies and everything?
They went all out. They went all out. It was probably more animated than the Queen version. Like, they were literally screaming and they're like, you know, it was...
Two things on this. Number one, if you are the producer of that album, this podcast is open for sponsors. That's thing number one. Let's just, you know, I'm using some free, royalty-free music right now for this podcast, but I am open for conversation. And thing number two, let's just lay out, you know, the context here again of a Chinese restaurant in the middle of Birkenhead, which we have outlined is the Coney Island of England, right? So the first ever real job that I had was as a tour guide for the University of Liverpool. And one of the main facts that was kind of drilled into my head in that job was that Liverpool is home to the largest and oldest Chinese population outside of China, right? Like, in terms of Europe, in terms of where Chinese people first settled when they moved out of China, it was the Liverpool area, and by extension, Birkenhead. So Chinese restaurants and Chinese business as a whole is big business in this area, right? So it's not unusual for a restaurant in that area, even though it is a relatively poor area, to do pretty well, right? You know, it would make sense that this had the potential to be a pretty nice place.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. You're walking around, cleaning glasses, Chinese Bohemian Rhapsody is playing. I'm struggling to see why this is the worst job you've ever had.
Well, it gets worse. That's only skimming the surface.
Okay.
So, you know, there were a lot of customers that were coming in, and a lot of the clientele from Burton, this is just the first shift as well. A lot of the clientele that you have in Birkenhead are very, lack of a better word, they're very rough.
I really thought you were going to do something to lessen the blow of that then. Well, I really thought you were trying to find something really inoffensive, and then you just go, we're leaving it in, we're doing it live, carry on. Yeah,
okay. And, you know, they were very aggressive to the staff, but they were quite favouring towards me. And I think I know why. I think, you know, they didn't particularly have nice thoughts about this culture.
I think you were just the white waiter for the job. That's all in it. White place at the white time.
I think so. And I think, you know, they found a friend in me, but I didn't find a friend in them. You know, they'd kick off over, you know, some of the food being too spicy. It was like a buffet setting. So people got up and got the food. They were quite aggressive towards the Chinese people, but they were very nice towards me. Anyway, someone got really out of hand, and they wouldn't have a go at me, even though I was the waiter bringing the food over to them or the drinks over to them. Really, the people they should have kicked off on was me with some of the things that happened, but they chose and targeted the Chinese people. And they had to bring the police in. And the police came in and had them away, and they were spitting on the Chinese people. Ooh. It was really horrific. Absolutely horrific. It was really rough. As I say, this is just the first shift as well. And there was no, someone I should mention, none of the staff spoke English. They spoke, the waitress spoke little bits of English,
mm-hmm.
not enough to string a sentence or to have a conversation with. So I kind of wrapped up and I said, when do you need me in? He was like, tomorrow. I was like, okay, do we get paid weekly or do we get paid monthly? And he goes, next week, big money. I was like, okay. Now, by this point, again, no contracts were signed. And as from what I was aware, even though I disagreed with it, as far as I was aware, it was £40 a shift. Now, throughout that week, as well as the first shift I did, I worked for 10 hours. So technically, I was getting paid £4 an hour. I was 24 years old at the time. Now, that's illegal. And if I wanted to, I could have sued them over it. But I think one thing that really struck me about their culture during that week I was there is their culture is very, the workaholics, I think is the best way to describe it. They work constantly. They live and breathe working. And, you know, they really, when they do have time off, it's once in the blue moon, you know, whether it's Chinese New Year or someone's birthday. And I learned this when I told them to the best of my ability. I said, I've got arrangements, you know, I need to book time off. I've got a girlfriend. And the waitress was trying to convey this to the manager and was like, you know, he's got a girlfriend. And he just kind of looked at me and, you know, his looks could kill. And he looked back at the waitress and was and he said something to her in Chinese. And she looked at me and she said it wasn't an eligible reason to book time off. It wasn't like a special holiday or a special occasion, you know. By this point, I had tickets already booked to go to Dusseldorf mm-hmm. to see my girlfriend in Germany. And I was like, right, well, I said, I've already booked this. And she was like, yeah, but, you know, just, you know, she was trying to speak to him and say, well, you know, it's his girlfriend, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, oh, and he didn't want to, he was like, I've heard the end of it, moving on. So he didn't give me any time off.
There's,
so
there's no already, big money in Germany, Andrew. There's no big money over there.
So basically, he kind of just, he already, posed himself as an unapproachable manager, which I'm sure even you from jobs you've had is the worst kind of manager you can have, a very unapproachable manager. You can't get time off.
I had a job interview once, and I won't name the company, but the job is to unite utilities.
Okay.
It's very, very subtle. I think you can agree. It was they unite utilities, this company that I went for an interview with. And it was, you know, it was an entry-level professional position. It was as a land use planner. And I was in my relationship at this time. I believe I was actually engaged. And my wife is American, and at the time, we were still considering remaining in the UK. So I go for this job interview, and we're kind of talking, and they asked me a whole bunch of inappropriate questions. But the one that really stuck with me is they said to me, so you kind of mentioned offhand that your fiancé is American. Are you planning on using your holiday days to go and visit America? Will you need holiday days? And I'm like, well, don't I get some by law? Yes, but are you planning on taking them? I'm like, well, guess I'm not getting this job then. This has been nice. Thanks for your time, I guess. Maybe. Oops.
So that it didn't work out then.
Strangely enough, I don't work at a company who unites utilities, no.
What an odd...
So it didn't work out.
No, what an odd experience that is. Crazy, isn't it? But they just did not, it was just a culture clash, really. They just didn't understand that, you know, we, at least in Western civilization, you know, holidays, you know, holidays quite easy to go by, really, aren't they? You can book holidays in advance. They're quite easy to do, you know, and you can even book days off pretty easily. There's that communication. But in Chinese culture, it's very different. And, you know, you've just, I always knew it was quite like that, but I didn't realize it until that experience where, you know, I just spoke to them in confidence. Look, I've got this girlfriend, or, you know, I've got this acting gig coming up later in the year. Could I book it off? And they just didn't see it as a feasible reason to take time off. So already I had, and this was the first shift, already I had plans to look elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, just ride it out. Because after all, you know, once trial week's over, it should be national minimum wage. It should be, you know, by law. And as the week went on, and they always kind of dodged the conversation about money, I kind of learned that, right, okay, this isn't going to happen. And so eventually, I realized that I couldn't be there much longer. So I came in the next day, and the waitress, who I somewhat got fairly acquainted to, wasn't there. It was just me and the manager. And I was like looking for something to do. Everyone had gone back, you know, all the kids had gone back to school
mm-hmm.
at this point. So none of the parents were around, you know, or families. So, you know, to get a customer in was far and few between. I'd be, you know, wandering around the restaurant, just finding something to do, listening to Bohemian Rhapsody, the Cantonese version.
Yeah.
And I'd kind of hum it to myself, and I'd kind of look up. And behind the bar was the manager of the restaurant. And he was just, again, if looks could kill, he was just staring at me from, like, over the bar. And he'd even, like, flinch. And I'd kind of, like, shuffle along and see if his eyes would follow me. And they did. It was like, I'm sure he was planning to murder me for some reason. It was just like...
I'm just kind of picturing you approaching this man the same way that tourists approach the guards down at the Tower of London, like just running up to him and trying to make him flinch or do anything.
Yeah.
And he's just standing there with a big woolly hat on, refusing to move.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd be perfect for the job. But but anyway, one of the perks of the job was we got free food. So if it was lunchtime, you know, we were allowed to eat at the buffet for 30 minutes, and same with dinner time in the evening as well. So later in the day, things started to pick up business wise, and you could hear a lot of like scuffling and a lot of shouting and arguing, and all the customers were being really curious, including myself. And I always wondered, where's the kitchen? Because the kitchen was actually above the restaurant. And they actually had to, there's like an elevator shaft where they put the food in and lower it down to refill at the buffet and stuff like that. But there was shouting so loud, you could hear it from this elevator shaft. And it was all in Chinese, they're all screaming and shouting. You could hear glasses being smashed and everything. And everyone was just going around going, what the hell's going on? Anyway.
And you're not able to use the Chinese that you picked up from Bohemian Rhapsody to translate.
I couldn't. I really couldn't at all. It was frustrating. But
they weren't screaming, "Mama just killed a man." You couldn't pick that up.
I couldn't pick that up. And no.
Okay.
Because the funny thing is, you could tell with the song, you could tell which bit it was. But it was all so fast and quick. You couldn't pick up the kind of dialect or the punctuation. You know, it was just Chinese. Best way to describe it. But anyway, these two chefs came down and they're like, just shouting and screaming and pointing at each other. And the manager joined in and he was screaming and shouting and pointing at each other. And one of them got a knife out. One got a knife out from his apron and was waving it about. He was like, kill you or whatever. You know, screaming and shouting. The manager distracted him and he turned around and he was like screaming and shouting at the manager then. And whilst he was screaming and shouting at the manager, the other chef from behind. He just got, he had this towel around his neck. It was like Samoa Joe. He had this towel around his neck and he got this towel and he tightened the towel into like, you know, just made it more of a, just made it tight. And he just kind of, it was very calculated. He just kind of positioned himself and he whacked this towel and it clipped the other chef at the back of the ear, like that. And all you heard from the chef was, ah, like that. And it was in front of customers as well. And it was just so absolutely mental.
So just so I'm clear on what's going on here.
All right, go on.
You've got a guy brandishing a knife in a crowded buffet restaurant, which, let's face it, you know, I'm particular to a Chinese buffet myself. You know, I think we can all admit that from time to time. They're a crowded place that is difficult to move around at the best of times. So we've got this madman armed with a knife in the middle of the restaurant. And then this other guy decides that the best course of action to take is to whip him with a towel like he's a year seven in a PE locker room.
That is what happened. It just...
Does like, this guy have like a self-defense YouTube channel now?
Well, that's what I mean. You know, it was like he just got threatened with a knife. You know, it was like a mistake. And he didn't even flinch when it happened. So it must have happened before. You know, like flaunting this knife and the other chef's like, yeah, you said that last time, didn't do anything. So when he turned around, you know, he just got this towel whoosh, like that. And the other chef just squealed really loud. Was like, like that, and he like just collapsed onto his knees. He was like, like that, like covering his ear.
Which, to be fair, was my reaction when I used to get whipped with towels in the year 7 PE locker room. So I can appreciate that.
Yeah, but probably not behind the ear. I think having it on the bottom is very different to on the ear. I think having it on the bottom now, looking back in hindsight, you'd probably appreciate. You'd be like, thank God, it's on my bottom. That was quite nice. You know, whereas this
surface area dissipates the impact. You know, I can appreciate that.
Absolutely. It was just mental. But the thing that really struck...
This is officially a towel whipping podcast now about the physics of getting whipped with towels. Please join us next week as we discuss the difference between white towels and brown towels and how they affect you. So we've got a chef, he's on his knees and he's crying.
He's crying and the other chef walked away and the manager just threw his arms up in the air. I was like, you know, what I don't know why I'm bothering, you know. But the thing that really stuck out to me the most in that moment was looking around the restaurant, and as stunned as people were, they didn't leave. They just kind of kept eating, and I thought, this is interesting, this. Like this, you know, if it was any other area or location, like Heswell Village, for example. I don't know if you're familiar with Heswell. Or even Liverpool. Like, people in Liverpool would just walk out and go, no, don't need my evening to be like that, thank you. Whereas in Birkenhead, they were like, I don't know, but that's what I mean. Like, Birkenhead, it's like the Wild West. But, you know, all kinds of things happen. It's a free-for-all.
I'm going to challenge you on that. And I'm going to say that what you saw was pure economics in action. Because when you go to a buffet restaurant, you pay your $14.99 or whatever it might be, and you're in it for the long haul.
Well, that's true.
You've got to get as many plates as you can to make that $14.99 worth it. I was in Tampa, Florida, back in 2013, and it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. I had just been to a showing of Monsters University, as you do at 11 o'clock at night. And my friends and I decided it was time to get something to eat. So we go to Denny's, which is a 24/7 food establishment that specializes in breakfast.
Gotcha.
And the three of us sit down. We each order a strawberry lemonade, and at that point, we hear a door slam open from the bathroom, and a very large lady is dragging a child behind her. The child is seated on the floor. She has him by the scruff of the neck, and she's dragging him behind her like he's one of those red radio flyer carts that all the people have in the movie. She's dragging this child, and he is projectile vomiting as he goes. So she's just dragging this streaming child behind her, and she drags him back to the table, sits him down, calls over a waiter, and describes that alleges that the child was sick because the restaurant had given him poisoned grapes. And when the manager explained that that couldn't possibly be true and the child was more likely just suffering from sunstroke, and also he was like 3 and it was 2 o'clock in the morning, the woman grabbed the manager by the neck. Now, me and my friends at that point put our to-go lids on our strawberry lemonades and we left because not much money had exchanged hands, so the economics allowed us to leave. But if I was in a restaurant that was a buffet and I'd already paid, you better believe I'm sticking that one out.
Actually, whilst all that commotion's happening, you'd probably be sticking food down your pockets while they're not
it's
looking.
It's the perfect opportunity. You pre-line them with tin foil before you go in, and you're away. So, Andrew, you've got to promise me something. So we've had no big money. We've had basically the death blow stuck to your relationship because you're not allowed to go and visit your girlfriend.
Mm.
We've had towel beats knife in a game of rock towel knife. You've got to promise me that was your last shift. How does this end? Is this where you leave, or do you somehow decide to stick it out?
Phil, that was not my last shift. I stuck it out for another 3 days, pretty much. Another three days. So I kind of drove home that night. It was one of them things where, and we all do it, sometimes you drive home and play on our phone in the car before we go in, like read the messages. I don't know, sometimes I think we do it, but in this instance, I didn't even look at my phone, just kind of pulled up at the driveway, sat in the car, and I must have been there for about an hour staring into space, thinking, what was that? What was that? It was like you couldn't even write it, you know. It was
just as an actor getting ready for your inevitable appearance on Crime Watch to reconstruct the scene.
To reenact it, yeah. Whilst having post-traumatic stress disorder from all happening. Yeah. It was just wacky, and a part of me couldn't wait to leave, but another part of me was curious as to, can it get worse than this? So the next day I went in, and the waitress was there, and I tried to get a little bit more acquainted to the waitress I was working with, and I was like, just out of curiosity, how much do you, like, what's the national minimum wage? And she was like, national minimum wage? I went, yeah, you know, we all in this country, we have a national minimum wage. So at the time I was 24, so the national minimum wage, if I remember correctly, for 24 at that time was £7.30, I think.
Yeah, right around there.
Yeah, and which is a lot more than £4, I'll tell you that. So I thought, how long were you on this trial week for before you got national minimum wage? And she was like, I don't think we do national minimum wage. I was like, what do you mean you don't do national minimum wage? And she was like, well, we still do. We still do what we did on our first week. By this point, she'd been there for 2 years. And she was like, yeah, I just say, same money, you know. And I was like, £4 an hour. Like, she was like, yeah. And I was like, I said, I whispered to her, I said, you could get him sued for that. I said, that's illegal. You're entitled to national minimum wage. And I don't think her English was strong enough to understand what I was saying or the seriousness of it, you know. But I kept saying to her, I said, you deserve more than this. Like, you know, you shouldn't be working, you know, for 12 hours mm-hmm. nearly every day of the week, mm-hmm. more or less every day for the week for £4 an hour. And she was about 23 at the time. She was only a year younger than me. I said, something needs to be done about that. But I didn't say anything, and the manager couldn't speak a word of English. So it would have been a wasted it just would have been wasted breath, really, to try and talk to him about it and say, this is wrong, you know, we're entitled to more pay. I thought, well, ride it out, I said, because this job's better than no job at the moment, and just hope for the best. And, you know, in between shifts, I was on Indeed, still looking for jobs. Well, the manager's kids came into the restaurant, and they could speak English as well as Cantonese.
Okay.
It was nice to talk to someone who was English, or spoke English for a change, you know. In the workplace,
as opposed to people from Birkenhead who definitely do not speak English,
do not speak any coherent bits of English whatsoever.
Anything that would be established as English, so you weren't even getting any conversation off the customers.
Absolutely not. So and it was just nice to talk to them, but they were kids, so I couldn't talk to them about finances, saying, how much do you think, asking the kids, how much, what's the national minimum wage to you? Like, what do you think it is?
So you couldn't organise a union of 11-year-olds, that's what you're saying to me.
I couldn't organise a strike. you know, it was just, you know, but it was just mental. So, I could only get so far talking to them. And when it got busy, the manager... it was two twins, the children. It was a boy and a girl, and he was like, up you go, you know, to the bar.
Mm-hmm.
And they were about 10, 11, and they got these aprons that were like tents on them, stood up on stools and started pulling pints. I was just kind of watching this happen, and the public weren't even questioning it at all. You know, they were pulling pints and, you know, exchanging money and making cocktails. I can't believe it. They were making cocktails.
Were they good? Did you try one?
I didn't try one, but there were no complaints, so they must have been pretty good at it. But being pretty good at it is one thing, but being pretty good at it as a child is a whole new level. It goes on to the other end of the spectrum. So I was absolutely baffled. It was crazy. But they weren't getting paid for it. It was like a family kind of favour. You know, when you get home from school, you come to the restaurant and you pull the pint. And, it was absolutely mental. And they were like, I don't know if you've ever worked in the bar industry, but they knew certain bar codes. So if it was like a single drink, so like if it was like a single vodka and Coke, you know, it's one fist. And if it's a double, you put two fists together to say it's a double. And they knew, and this is all like bar terminology. And
so they spoke phrases. English, Cantonese, and bartender is what you're telling me. They spoke three languages by the age of 11.
It's like sign language for bartenders. And I thought, how do you know this? So they may as well try and talk to the manager through bartending. You know, try and say, when are you going to pay me? You know, in bartending
language. So you put two fists together to say, I want double wages.
Yeah. And then you'll just give me the middle finger and say, that's one way for you. So that was absolutely, just absolutely mental. And then I noticed on that particular shift, a lot of the English customers were giving me tips specifically. And they were like, here's a tip for you. And I said, oh, no, there's a jar at the bar. And they said, no. They said they don't give tips out to the staff. I don't know what they do with it. So you keep that to yourself and you hide it. And, you know, they'd give you like £5 notes. Now, £5 for a tip in England is not bad at all.
That's,
you know,
that's big money.
It is big money. So, it, you know, I made more money through the tips than I did with the wages. And it got to the end of the week, and it was cash in hand, so they were paying weekly. It was cash in hand, so they gave me £140 for the week. And I was like, and I thought, right, this is, I'm gonna try this one more time. I'm gonna ask about the big money. Okay. So I said, so I've done my trial week, have I got the job, do I sign anything? And, you know, she was trying to communicate with the manager, explain what I said. And they were like, no, don't sign anything. Just turn up to work and get your money. And I said, all right, So do I get more next week? I said, because I should be getting, and I gave them the wage it would have been at the time, £7 something. We'll just say £7.30 for now. And he kind of gave me evils, and then he looked at the waitress and gave me evils again, and looked at her and was like, no, we don't do that. And she was just like, no, I'm sorry, but it's not like that here. It's, you know, this is as much as you're gonna get. And I suppose to their culture, £4 an hour, that is big money. That probably is big money to them.
Or, conspiracy theory, he was making the big money because he was skimming the rest of the wage off the top.
Ooh. And that, I did not think of. It probably was. So when you were saying big money, he was thinking, he was talking to himself. It was like a self-internal monologue. Big money for me.
It's, right, you know, like, you know, you're an actor, you know how it is. Sometimes before you go out and put on a performance, you have like a little mantra that you repeat to yourself, and maybe he was just repeating it out loud, and you probably just happened to get overhear it.
Probably, yeah. He probably didn't have a mirror at home to reenact it, so he kind of does it through people he talks to by text.
Just puts it out in the world, in his text messages. Big money. Well, Andrew, that was the worst job you ever had. You almost witnessed a murder. You were the poster boy for white supremacy in Birkenhead, I think it's safe to say. I don't think it's unfair to say that. You never quite made the big money, but did you make it over to Germany? Let's end it on a happy ending.
Okay, let's end it on a funny but happy ending. So at the end of that week, I had an opportunity to go for a different job, which was a little bit more reliable and could cover me until the next acting gig, which was May at the time. So it was the end of what would have been, in their words, my trial week. And I got this job opportunity, and I knew I'd get the job anyway because I was more than qualified to get it with previous experience. It was at a cinema in Bromborough, and I thought, yeah, I'll get this. I said, so much so, I'm just going to walk out of the restaurant, and which is out of my character. Usually I'm very loyal, and, you know, if we've agreed on something, you know, and there's like a form of trust or bond there, I will deliver.
You'll see it through, right?
I'll deliver. But in this case, I hadn't signed anything, so they couldn't legally do anything if I had walked out the shop and said, oh, he didn't we're gonna get into trouble. There was no contract, there was no it was just a handshake. That's pretty much what it was. And even if they did say, well, you know, he didn't finish his shift, I could have said, well, you were underpaying your staff horribly and get them into trouble. So anyway, I just didn't turn up to shift one day and had a nice lie-in. And there was like loads of missed calls and loads of voicemails. And it was all broken English voicemails. It was like, so in Chinese, Andrew is Andaru. So it's not that much different, but obviously there's like that Cantonese drawl to it. And it's like, and Andrew, where are you? Need you. Busy, you know. And I sent them a text and I said, look, I said, you know, thank you for allowing me to work with you, but I found somewhere else that's more suitable for me. And they didn't reply back for about 5 hours.
Okay.
And then I got this text back saying, I mean, it's not verbatim, but it was, but Andrew, what about the big money? What about the big money? And I thought, that's it, I've had enough of it. I had to block him.
I had to
block him.
You left £4 an hour on the table to chase some pie in the sky dream of being an actor.
That's
reprehensible, my friend. Well, our time has pretty much come to an end, but before you go, I mean, you've said it yourself, you're quite the self-marketer. Is there anything you want to plug to the three people listening at home?
So to the three people, you wonderful three people who've listened in for this long. Thank you, first and foremost. Second of all, I'm making a film called Dandelicious, which is about a teddy boy in the 1950s. And teddy boys were the first anti-establishment youth culture in Britain during the 1950s. And it's very stylized. It's like Guy Ritchie meets Edgar Wright meets Sam Raimi. You know, it's quite larger than life. So we've been filming for about 2 years, and it's due out, once the coronavirus is over, it's due out this year. So you can follow the film at facebook.com/Dandelicious Movie or on Instagram at apg.film.
Smashing. Well, I will definitely be keeping an eye out, and it's always nice to have something to look forward to, right? So why not look forward to the release of a nice film?
Oh, thank you. Well, you're saying nice as if it's going to be like a family-friendly experience. but it's something I hope that will captivate your interest to those listening, if you do happen to do any research on it. And let me know what you think as well when it's out.
Yeah. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for coming and getting clocked off with me. I appreciate that.
No, I appreciate the clock off. Thank you very much, Paul. No, I really appreciate it. Totally enjoyed it. Good to hear from you again as well.
Good to hear from you, mate. Bye-bye.
Bye then.
Wasn't that lovely? Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Phil Green is Clocked Off. And Phil Green is Clocked Off is available wherever you get your podcasts every Tuesday and every Friday. And if you want to stay in touch and see what's coming up, hit subscribe and don't forget to join us on social media. We're Clocked Off Pod on Facebook, at Clocked Off Pod on Twitter, and Clocked Off Pod on Instagram as well. Appreciate you for joining us. Stay in touch. Bye.